Luke 23:33-34. And when they came to a place they called the Skull, where they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left. But Jesus was saying, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they cast lots, dividing up his garments from among themselves. Now, arriving at this location of the crucifixion, Mark 15:35, it's about 9 a.m. in the morning. He's had a rough night. He's already been beaten and tried for hours and carried that cross with the help of another. And the Roman guards, they stripped off his bloodied garments and nailed him to the cross. Now, all four Gospels virtually say they crucified him. And they say it in a way that, you know, really say it with brevity, as this is a matter of fact, they crucified him. Similar to if you would say you filled up your car. It's an everyday thing. This was an everyday issue that these people of this time, they saw. They weren't standing there going, "Oh my goodness, like, what's this?" Very likely Jesus walked by many crucified bodies when he was age 12 going to the Passover. This was a common form of punishment, and the Romans were experts at it. Notice there were three of them that were crucified that day. There could have been even more. The actual crucifixion, though, they would have had his wrist nailed to the patibulum or the crossbeam, and possibly even tied. A lot of times they would tie the crossbeam to them. It's about anywhere from 80 to 125 pounds. He would have carried it through, probably had it tied to him, fallen on his face a couple times. Then he was helped by Simon of Cyrene against his will, carried up there. Well, when they laid you back, the forearm was considered as part of the hand. They considered the hand everything up to the elbow. That's your hand. And so when I say they nailed him in the wrist, that was the most common place they'd do it, because to nail hair would not be really that great of a spot. You could tear that open. But here, there's a nice little sweet spot they love to hit, right there in the wrist. And very, very painful. When I was a child of about 11 years old, we built this tree fort. And, you know, it was the tree fort. Boy, we were proud of that. And I was hammering a lot of different things, but I noticed that I didn't take care of those nails that went through about like that. Well, we had, you know, little buckets you pulled up, you know, to pass things back and forth. And I was pulling that bucket up, and clunk, a nail went right through my right wrist, came out to the other side. And, like, I thought that's an instant death sentence. It's not, but I could not believe how fast I made it down that tree. It was incredible, because I thought, you know, I saw these people on TV, you know, they cut their wrist. I thought, "Oh, you're a dead man, Doug. You're not even a man." Phew, I went right down. And so I thought about that for a long time after, because not growing up in a Christian home, I had heard about Jesus, something about some nails. I think everybody did in my generation. And I often think back when they go to nail him to the wrist, the day that I got a nail through the wrist. But we know that he was nailed because Thomas mentions that in John chapter 20 about seeing the nail imprints and the thrust through his side. And the victim, after being fastened to that crossbeam, he would be lifted up on each side and then rested up to be nestled onto the stipus or the pole that they would hang them on. But what about the feet? The New Testament knows nothing of Jesus being nailed through the feet. However, David, in prophesying of the crucifixion of Jesus in Psalm 22, verse 16, it says, "They pierced my hands and my feet." It's often depicted in the movies as laying one hand foot over another, and then, "Okay, hold still, let me drive it through both feet. And that's not really what they were doing back then. That wouldn't have been a convenient one. What they typically did was they'd put your feet on the side of the stipus and then hammer a nail through each heel. And then you were stuck there. It's a very, very graphic issue. They'd be able to push up on that very painfully. And see, you have to know that when they drive these nails in to the hands and the heels, that it would radiate pain throughout the shoulders, into the neck, up the leg, and down the sides. They hit some serious nerves when they did this. And, you know, in 1968, building contractors were working in a suburb in North Jerusalem, and they accidentally uncovered a Jewish tomb. And this Jewish tomb is dated to the first century after Jesus. They, in this Jewish ossuary, where they put the bones, there was a name on there called Jehohanan. And this 20 man in his 20s apparently had been crucified. And the evidence of this was based on the right heel bone of the, in fact, I might have a little picture here. The right heel bone, you go on the internet and look at this. They found his heel bone and had the nail still stuck in it. Apparently, that 11.5 centimeter nail that they hammered into the side had hit a knot hole and bent in, and they couldn't get the nail out. So they just, what they do is they just take a sword and, or an axe and just cut the ankle off and then pry the whole thing off together. It was a very graphic thing. Doug, you're upsetting me. I wanted to sanitize. Jesus, you're not going to get it, okay? It would have been so much easier to have Jesus be put to death by lethal injection. But folks, that's not what happened. There was no humane in capital punishment back then. The only way you could have humane is to take the human out of it. And you didn't get that way. And another thought concerning the suffering on the cross was the dislocation of the elbows and shoulders because of the pull of gravity on the body. Once that occurred, as the person would hang there, they begin to sag, and they'd have to push up on those nailed feet. Push up, because if you hang by your hands, you just tie yourself up, you will begin to asphyxiate. You can't blow out the air because the weight of you're on there, and eventually fatigue would set in, the shoulders would separate, the elbows would separate, and the person could only push up. They could sometimes, we know of actual accounts where people hung on the cross for up to 9 days. And it was just a terrible, terrible way to die. And so you imagine the pain, the exhaustion. He's already beaten. When they tore off his clothes, it would have pulled open those wounds. You know, the bugs would have been attracted to the open scabs and the flesh. It was just a miserable, awful way to die. You know, next time one of your friends, who's one of these like activists or something, say, you know, I know what you do to dogs. Sometimes people mistreat animals and stuff. But let me tell you, use it as an opportunity to say, speaking of mistreatment, did you understand how Jesus was crucified? You want an in for the gospel? Next time the death penalty comes up and somebody says, oh, that's just so inhumane. Say, speaking of that, did you hear what they did to Jesus? Because they don't even know what they're talking about till they go in and look how this man died. It was terrible. And beyond that, they were casting lots. John says in John chapter 19, verse 23 and 24, the soldiers therefore, when they had crucified Jesus, took his outer garments and made four parts. And a part to every soldier. But then there was that tunic. Now the tunic was seamless and woven in one piece. That's a very valuable garment. And they said therefore to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots to decide who shall it be. That the scripture might be fulfilled, they divided my outer garments among them. For my clothing they cast lots. This is quoting Psalm 22, verse 18. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Everything's fallen right into place. Man, God is a master planner, isn't he? When God says something 10 centuries ago, CNN is just breaking news, okay? I mean, God stands outside of time. He saw exactly how it was going to happen, and he dropped little clues so they could know that Jesus was the one. We'll cover that next week. But as prophesied many centuries prior, God knew that his son would hang naked on the cross. More than 33 years prior to this event, angels sang and shepherds rejoiced as he was born into the world, naked and in need of clothing. Luke chapter 2, verse 12. That's way towards the beginning of this series. And this day he'd be stripped of clothing and hung naked and on display before mockers, blasphemers, the ignorant, and those whom he dearly loved. As usual, these soldiers, they had the rights to those clothing. And they weren't going to have it go to waste. It's also in the text that we read here the first seven statements from the cross. These are seven great bits of wisdom that I aim at helping you and myself in our Christian lives. You've heard about the Sermon on the Mount, and you've heard about the Sermon in the Plain, and the Sermon at Pentecost. Oh, a lot of great sermons in the Bible. But I would like to propose to you this morning, over these next few lessons, as we finish the covering of the cross of Christ, the Sermon on the Cross is his finest. Let's go with part one. His statement: Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. I am amazed at the mind of our Savior. He was beaten, he was mocked, he was shredded, he was spit upon. They said every kind of evil thing to him, but he never lost focus. He was dying for the sinners of the world, not dying to them. It would have been easy to look around. And you know how it is. If somebody did these things to you, oh, I tell you what, we would have some serious things to say about them. You can't do this. You're not entitled to do this. I didn't do anything wrong. Well, I'm calling my attorney. Somebody, call an attorney. That's how we'd behave. I'll sue you for everything you have. I'm glad Jesus is better than us. It's hard to worship someone lower than you, isn't it? Luke 23, verse 35 to 37, it said, "And even the rulers were sneering at him, saying, 'He saved others. Let him save himself if he is the Christ, his chosen one.' And the soldiers mocked him, and coming to him, offering him sour wine, saying, 'If you're the king of the Jews, save yourself.'" It's a terrible time. And Jesus looks around, seeing all the things that are held against him, and he reaches down deep into his heart, and he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." I like to think he was modeling. He was demonstrating something that we need to have in the church today and forevermore. We often cannot look past the sinner to see the value that God sees in their lives and ours. It was his intention not to go to the grave with a personal grudge. God will deal with that. We would do well to pay attention to his words. Are you holding a grudge against another? Did someone put a hurt on you? Think about it. This day, did somebody put a hurt on me that I'm worthy to hold a grudge? You think so? Is there any grudge, any sorrow, any hurt, any pain, revenge, complaint, bitterness, regret, burden against another worth carrying around in this life? I can promise you, that is not God calling. He's calling from here in the Bible. The point is very simple. Turn it over to God today. Don't pass up that opportunity. Turn it over to God today. Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing. But God, you don't understand. This person said some hurtful things. Let it go. This person owes me money. Let it go. This person did hurt to me. You can't even begin to imagine, God. Jesus says, I know what you're talking about. Forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Let it go. Can you just let it go? But they didn't apologize. Let it go. But they didn't itemize their sin to me. Let it go. But I haven't been restored to yet. Would you just let it go? You can pray that they'll come to their senses. You can let them know that you let it go. But you have to let it go. There are people that, you know, did terrible things to me, just like you've had terrible things done to you. What do you do after they're in the grave? You still hang on to it? Do you show up on the Jerry Springer show or something? You say, they did terrible stuff to me and they're dead. Well, you better learn to let it go. You have to let it go. In fact, become an expert. I'm not saying become a pacifist. It's okay to say when things are wrong. But we need to learn the lesson that Jesus did. Listen, I'm going to go to my grave and I'm not going to hold a personal grudge against you. Now, there will be judgment. Each man will be judged according to his deeds. But the human side of Jesus is saying, let it go. Then in Luke 23, verse 39 through 43, one of the criminals who were hanged there was hurling abuse at him, saying, are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other answered, rebuking him, do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence and condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving what we deserve for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. And he was saying, Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom. He said to him, truly, I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise. There were two criminals hanging up there on those crosses, one on the right, one on the left. They were in rebellion to Rome. They were criminals. They were like Barabbas. They hung those insurrectionists up. If you weren't with Rome, they hung you up. They made a spectacle of them. And one of them begins to rail on Jesus. Now picture, now the man's hands are bound. He is going nowhere. His palm pilot is cleared, okay? There is nothing else for him to do. And he's strung out and he says, you know, if you're the Christ, then save yourself and us. We're on the same team, Jesus. I see your sign. They're crucifying you. We're together. But he's mocking him. This man tried to fight against the Roman rule, but now he's hanging on the cross. He could not have been more wrong, for Jesus was not that kind of king, and his kingdom was not that kind of world. He was blaspheming Jesus, even though he's in no better position. There was ever a time to be humble. Now's the time. And you have to love the nameless criminal on the other side of the cross. He rebuked the first, reminding him of two most important facts. Here they are. Two most important facts. Number one, the two of them are sinners. He reminds that other cross inhabitant. He says, hey, you and me, we're sinners. We're up here because of what we did. We are justified in being here. And number two, Jesus right here, he is not supposed to be here. He did not do something to be hung up on this cross. We did, he didn't. Don't try to lump us together. We all might have some crosses, but we all have different reasons for being here. And with that as the backdrop, he made the request of Jesus, "Remember me when you come in your kingdom." What a remarkable statement of faith from a nameless man who was hanging to death for his crimes. Somewhere between the death sentence and this moment, he came to the realization that the kingdom that he had been fighting for was not the kingdom in this life, but in the afterlife. He understood that they will die on the crosses that day, but there will be a resurrection. And the kingdom that Jesus was referring to, that he was fighting for, was not down here, but it was in the after death, or hence the afterlife. The other criminal could not come to that conclusion because he was not thinking spiritually. The second criminal had just had trust in Jesus as the king and his kingdom as a spiritual kingdom. Do you see how the one is saying, "Hey, we're all in this together." And the other one says, "No, different situation." And there you have Jesus. I don't think Jesus minded being caught in the middle of that conversation. It's exactly what Jesus had affirmed to Pilate only hours before. Do you remember in John 18:36? He said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting that I might not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." I think that second criminal got a little wind of that. And he saw Jesus as king. And he saw the kingdom Jesus was referring to. This is what we like about the second criminal, for he understood Jesus to be a king with a capital K, and the spiritual kingdom be that of hope and salvation. He wanted to be on the right side of Jesus, not literally, but figuratively. When this thing is over, to which Jesus said, "Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise." There it is, the statement number two. First one was, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." But now Jesus said, "Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise." Oh, what a point. What a point. You know, down at Sunset, we used to have a saying. If we wanted to really make a point, we'd say, "Hey, that stuff will preach. That'll preach." But let me tell you, this verse shall not pass by me today, because that'll preach. So we're going to go ahead and talk about it. Jesus affirmed to that trusting criminal that he would be with Jesus in paradise. Not tomorrow, not 10 years from now, but today you shall be with me in paradise. It's referring to, appreciate what he's saying, it was Hades that Jesus went to. It's the place of disembodied souls. It's where everybody who dies, and you all qualify for this program, feel the pulsating feeling in your wrist. When that stops, okay, you have a reservation in Hades. And it has two sides, Tartarus, which is the lost side, and it has Paradiso, paradise, the saved side. It was the place that the rich man and Lazarus went to in Luke chapter 16. It was the place that all the people will enter upon death and be resurrected from on the day of judgment, 1 Thessalonians 4, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. It was the place that Jesus went to following his death, Acts chapter 2, Brother Mackey read it, and Jesus holds the keys to that, Revelation chapter 1. It is where they went today. The resurrection will occur later for that. criminal. The thief desired to enter into the kingdom. Jesus entered him into the safe side of Hades called paradise. He could not simply take him into heaven, for that was not where he was headed. He was headed to Hades. He had to overcome death. And when the thief desired to enter into the kingdom, Jesus entered him into paradise. Now, I want to drive this point home. There were three crosses on the hill that day. On one side, a criminal reviled, that reviled at the thought of Jesus as being some sort of king. The other side, a criminal that recognized Jesus as the king and named the spiritual kingdom to be ushered in. In the middle was the omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent King of Kings, Lord of Lords, the seven horns, seven-eyed lamb that speaks, perfect sheep and perfect shepherd, Jesus. That's who was in the middle. And what you have to understand is that it didn't matter that Jesus did not yet die on the cross when he said that to the criminal. For he had the power to forgive man of their sins both before and after the cross. Go back and read Luke 5:24. Jesus was forgiving people before. And guess what? He's going to be forgiven after. And it did not matter that the criminal had not been a follower of Jesus for very long, having been a recent recognizer of that king. It did not matter that the church had not yet begun, for the day of Pentecost was 50 days from then. It did not matter that Jesus had not commanded baptism as part of salvation in the new covenant, for that time had not yet arrived. The point of the passage is not when and whom, but how and why. Don't confuse the questions and don't confuse the covenants. He was able to be spared from condemnation just like Adam, just like Abraham, just like Moses, just like David, just like Solomon, just like John the Baptist, just like Peter, just like James, John, Paul, and the rest of the saved because he saw Jesus as king and heaven as his kingdom. That's the point of it. And for this calculation, for him making the right educated decision, he would be in paradise. And that's awesome. 1 Timothy 1 verse 7 says this, now to the king, who? The king, who? The king, eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God, be glory forever and ever. Man, amen. That's what he says. How can you talk about a king and forever and ever and not want to amen that? So the conclusion I leave you with here this morning, before you go home and eat your turkey or your ham or whatever it is you're thinking about, okay? I want you to be thinking about this. Don't forget that Jesus has the power on earth to be your king and to put you in his kingdom. Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise. That is, do you believe he's the king? The king of kings. Not like king of some nation, king of all. And that heaven is his kingdom. If you don't have that down, it's not paradise for you. You must believe that. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man cometh unto the Father but by me. Are you willing to trust him only? Are you willing to commit your life to him fully? You know what? He can't be your king unless if you're willing to be his servant. That's the point. And so here's how you know that. Tonight we're going to cover the next two things Jesus said from the cross. But I want to leave you with this morning. You've heard the saying, how I love thee, let me count the ways. I think the more you can look at something and see more reasons for it, the more reasons you have to hold to it. When you are baptized, there's a reason for that. If you go through over and over again of what they taught in the book of Acts, they had to understand a kingdom, and they had to understand that Jesus was king. Go back and read every conversion. You leave this life, and you come back up in the new life. And you should be able to say, day in and day out, God, you're the king. Jesus, you are king. You are such a king. I bow down to you. And I'm part of your kingdom. But we enter that when we have a believing baptism. If you have not yet done that, sure, you can take the path of the thief on the cross, the criminal. You can do that. But that was under a different route. You have to actually base it on Jesus' death, burial, resurrection. The thief couldn't do that because Jesus was still alive. He didn't have a chance to do that. You do. So I leave you with this thought. What's your excuse? What is it? Is Jesus king? Are you in his kingdom? If you haven't made that decision yet, what you think about that? Maybe come forward while we stand and sing. And if you're afraid, because I know some of you are, then go back and one of the elders will talk to you. Tim's going to grab you back there, or I'll grab you here. But either which way, make Jesus your king today.